So we're ready to almost literally address the elephant in the room. We're joined by Dr. Vivek Menon, who is the founder and executive director of Wildlife Trust of India and the chair of the Asian Elephant Specialist Group. I'm Moni Boom.
And I'm Justin Burkhoff. Welcome to the Protect Species podcast, where we celebrate biodiversity and converse with conservationists.
Justin, slight curveball question before we start.
Oh, yeah? Yeah?
Yeah. If Only you slight. Had to have an animal body part for maybe like an hour or something, which one would it be and why?
Oh, that's a good one. I mean, wings sound like they'd be a lot of fun. But I don't know if I'd want wings to replace my arms or wings in addition to arms. So like butterfly wings, maybe. Like that could be fun. They'd be pretty, but they're very fragile. I'm not sure. I feel like this is... This is really a segue for you to tell me what you want.
Pretty. Yeah, that's because
I think monarch wings, really just monarch butterfly wings, really just.
Yeah, I really don't like you right now. however, I have obviously spent many an hour thinking about this. I would like to have an elephant's trunk instead of my nose, not in addition to it, because that would look really weird. I mean, it's the best. I will probably not give it back.
Who's going to come and take it?
Well, I don't know, but I said if you just had it for an hour, after that hour, I would not want to give it back.
What is so exciting about an elephant's trunk that you really want, like as opposed to like an okapi's tongue where you could like clean your ears with it?
Yeah, can you carry a watermelon with it though?
This is the bar right here is, can I carry a watermelon? You have hands. That's just
Only two.
True.
Okay. And the amount of times that I could do with an additional hand would also be
good.
Why
not a prehensile tail?
Alternatively, ooh, I could just have an elephant's trunk. Why do you not think that it's actually going to improve my face? I mean, in all reality, I think I would look pretty good. Have you seen Ganesha?
That's true. And you could snack while you were typing. That'd be pretty handy too.
That'd be cool. I could have a shower while typing. Maybe not on a keyboard.
It's probably not great for the computer, is it?
Yeah, no, that's splashing. Not good. But you could have a shower whenever you want to. You can just... wander about, just have a quick little drink. It's pretty awesome.
Just do a bucket next to your desk.
You could also just really annoy people by just kind of reaching over and stealing things from their desks. And given the fact that I sit very close to you, I would literally annoy you all day long with my
trunk. I thought you're not allowed to have an elephant's trunk based purely on the fact that we sit across from each other at our desk.
Speaking of sitting across from each other, you know what else I really like about elephants?
No, please tell me. I'm deeply interested and a little alarmed.
Again, I probably spent a little bit too much time on this, but I once invented a new game called Elephant Poo Shot Putt.
Did you keep your amateur status so you can compete in the Olympics?
Absolutely.
Excellent. When do we expect to see you in the Olympics for this?
I mean, you know, at the moment, we're just still trying to make it an Olympic sport. But I don't really see why it wouldn't, because it's like normal shot putt. So if you like, you know, track and field, it's got all of that. But the thump that it makes on landing is awesome.
Do you bring it in close to your chin? Like, of course. You get a little glue on your face, really lean into it?
Well, it's generally quite dry, isn't it?
Okay,
so,
yeah.
You know, it's generally all right. But it also sticks together quite well on landing. So I think it's probably easy to measure.
That's good.
Like, so are you like
the number one ranked?
What's the shotted, putted it? What is the verb?
I don't know.
Shot putted it. I don't know.
Neither
anyway,
of us are clearly
the lingo and the rule book are still in development. So, you know, we're working on that fast.
Does that mean you're the world ranked number one shot putter of elephant
poo? I mean,
poo?
I sincerely hope that nobody else has taken up the sport, because that's the only chance I have.
Okay. So other than the fact that you want to officially shot put elephant dung and you would love to have a trunk for an hour, but never give it back, which means more than an hour. What do you find fascinating about elephants?
I once wanted to really be an orphan elephant keeper. I used to dream about baby elephants. Yeah. No, I'd seen a program about orphan elephants and a project where they were looking after
them in
Africa, I think. And I was so obsessed. I kept dreaming about it every single night afterwards.
I mean, that's great. But watching videos of elephant orphans like run around, just run amok, just absolute chaos all the time, which probably really leans into the fact that you'd really like to have a trunk.
Correct. And then just play football with them. I think it would be not with a trunk, or with a ball. Okay.
With the elephants. Yes.
But with the elephants, as in the elephants, the baby orphan elephants play football with you. No, again, that sounds like they're kicking me. You know what I mean? We use a ball. Maybe I'm not the one to... Maybe I'm just the one to
explain. In their game of football, I think is the way you're trying to phrase that.
Okay, good. Excellent. Yeah, thank you very much.
You're welcome. I'm here all
English
week.
Is not my native language.
I'm not sure if that's helping either of us.
No, it probably doesn't. Shall we maybe get on with the podcast?
We should probably move towards that.
Good, excellent. What are we doing here?
We're going to be speaking with Vivek Menon, who is the chair of the Asian Elephant Specialist Group. And we're going to talk a little bit about Asian elephant conservation, how he got involved in Asian elephant conservation, and really kind of learn what the status is, what the big challenges are, and what he thinks the next steps for Asian elephants is going to be.
Do you think it would be okay if I asked him if he ever wanted to have an elephant's trunk instead of a nose?
I mean, if we have time, I'm going to encourage you to ask him. Really, because I'm curious how he'd respond. Just kind of like a physical response to that. And then also what his actual answer might be. I think we should ask all of our guests. We should also ask him if he can make an elephant noise impression, because we haven't done that in a while. I can also do that,
but I will not do that for the sake of our listeners and also for, you know, I don't know, my general face.
That's
goes
probably
a bit
for
funny.
The best.
Anyway, that used to also be an obsession of mine. Anyway, let's move on.
What, elephant noises?
Yeah.
That tracks. There's nothing about that that is remotely surprising.
I used to make a really good seagull impression.
I can't wait to experience that.
Oh, you can. Believe me. On with the podcast.
On with the podcast. Good morning, Vivek. How are you doing today?
Not too bad. Not too bad. Thank you.
Excellent. It's a little bit warmer today than it was yesterday.
Yeah, it was indeed.
It's supposed to be like 20 something today, I think. Celsius, for those that care.
Thank you very much.
So, Vivek, you know, to share with the guests, kind of, we'd love for you to introduce yourself briefly and talk a little bit about kind of the overall work that you do, and then we'll dive in a little bit deeper.
Yeah, like you said, I'm Vivek Menon, a conservationist from India. I've been working for now 36 years in conservation in various various forms. I started as an ornithologist, as a bird person, and then graduated to larger mammals. Especially the elephant. I've also been, I suppose, what you might call a serial entrepreneur in the nonprofit world. I founded 5 NGOs.
Wow!
And the fifth of which, the Wildlife Trust of India, has taken a life of its own. And starting from a spare bedroom in my home 25 years ago, has grown into one of the larger and hopefully more effective conservation organizations in India. So that's what I've been doing.
So how did you get into conservation? What's your origin story, so to speak?
So there's no one moment when I decided, and many people, some rather well-known people have asked me this on stage, including Sir David Attenborough, and I didn't have an answer. And
How did you get into it, Sir David? I mean,
absolutely. So when you don't know, you ask a question back. And yeah. I did exactly that. And he said, age 11, watching a pair of newts mate in my father's pond. So he was
very specific.
Super specific.
I unfortunately do not have such a story. But since I was young, there were two things. One is we were then, at that time, my father and my mother brought us up in a town which is the foothills of the Himalayas. So the school we went to made sure that we were hiking and trekking all the time in the Himalayas. So I suppose that inculcated in me a love for nature and walking in nature and appreciating nature. But I also used to keep animals and birds, all sorts of animals and birds. We lived in a large house. Both my parents were rather busy people and did not come to the part of the house that I stayed in. And so I used it entirely to keep everything from monkeys to owls to
I mean, that's quite the little menagerie.
So yeah, one did it, and one should not have done it, I suppose, looking back. But I comfort myself in saying that at least some of those animals were rescued and should have been looked after by somebody. But others, I bought off the trade, which is why one of the first things I did when I was a professional conservationist was to address the illegal wildlife trade, because I knew quite a bit about trading by buying these birds, largely birds, off the traders when I was a teenager.
Okay.
Cool.
I mean, yeah, that's how I stumbled into this.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting kind of point, because there are people that are in this field that very much have that kind of that singular gestalt moment where they're like, this is it, this is what it happened. But I also think there's a huge number of people that are in this field that bring other passions and other interests, and they do kind of just stumble into it. And, you know, like you don't have to have this as your life's goal from, you know, from an early age to really make a big impact. And
how did you get into it, Justin?
How did I get into it? Oh, I stumbled into it. Like, very honestly, I started as a undergrad student, as a pre-med student. I wanted to be an orthopedic surgeon. That was my goal in life. And then I discovered
I think we're all safer for it that he's now working in conservation.
Maybe, just maybe. And I had some experiences with, you know, HMO insurance in the United States, because we don't do socialized medicine here. And I really didn't enjoy it, because it wasn't what medicine should be.
Yeah.
And I was taking an animal physiology class and studied diving behavior in northern elephant seals, which was very niche. But
another elephant in the room.
Another elephant in the room. And that was really kind of what kind of sparked that as an original interest. And then kind of a fun happenstance, ended up working for a zoo that was styled as a safari park, and really got exposed to what conservation was from there. And so it was this kind of this an opportunity that arose. And at the time, I thought it'd be a fun summer job while I figure out where the rest of my life went. And 16 years later, I'm still doing it and still love it. So it was just very much kind of a stumbled into it. And I can't imagine my life doing something else. But when I found this, it wasn't something I had imagined for myself either.
It's very strange, because zoos played a part in my life as well. Mm-hmm. And again, stumbled into it completely. Was just walking the local zoo, Delhi Zoo, when I was in my first year of graduation. At that time, I had an interest in animals. I kept animals, as I said. I walked in nature, but I was not doing anything professional. Mm-hmm. And I was walking through, and I saw a man, a young man, casually approach a pheasant cage where there was a silver pheasant, I still remember, which came right up, probably looking for a handout. And instead, this chap took out a cigarette that he was smoking and stubbed it in the eye of the pheasant. Oof. Right? And I did what a young man would, which is I caught hold of him and beat him up and dragged him to the director's office and said, this is, you know, animal cruelty and what is this? And the director did whatever he had to do with the chap. But then later he told me that, you know, I don't have staff to manage this. And, you know, we need volunteers. Mm-hmm. And you are a young man and you are in university. Why don't you get a band of your friends and come and help me run the zoo if you can do a volunteer program? And that's what I did. So that is my first organized bit of stuff that I did. I gathered a group of first-year students and went to Delhi Zoo. All got shiny new badges as volunteers and tried to assist the zoo.
That's awesome. I suppose that brings us neatly to the next question. You know, a much bigger endeavor than this Delhi Zoo endeavor, the Wildlife Trust of India. What is it? What's its mission? What are you guys working on?
So Wildlife Trust of India, I founded in 1998. So that's 25 years to almost to the date. It was started when there was a little vacuum in India in terms of nature conservation. Two of the largest organizations had gone through a transition. There was a niche for doing work in the field, which in our sense was not research. We had, you know, given ourselves a niche of conservation action. That was a big blank. There were people doing research. There were people holding fundraisers and cocktail parties for wildlife, but there were very few people going out there and reversing what we now in IUCN call reversing the red, or working on species to ensure that they come back from decline, whether it is in terms of enforcement and wildlife crime, whether it was in terms of rehabilitation of animals, whether it's in terms of land securement or species recovery, you name it. There was a gap in the field. So the Wildlife Trust of India was founded on those principles of trying to identify at that time three or four ideas, which later over the years we started calling our big ideas.
Yeah.
And we have now nine of them. And nine big ideas are enough for nine lifetimes, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, I can give you one example of our land securement big idea. Mm-hmm. India conserves nearly 6% of its land surface under the protected area networks of the government. And the big idea of the Wildlife Trust of India is to add 1% of India to that. Through a privately buffered scheme.
So
that's
phenomenal.
A hugely ambitious goal,
yes.
Right? So we are in 0.02 or something after 25 years. So, but that's what a big idea should be, which is how can you work towards something that's a little beyond you when you think of it? But in a lifetime or two, that should be what you leave for posterity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like you said, it's ambitious, but it's not unachievable, and it'll have a lasting impact. And to say that, you know, this organization that you mentioned you started 25 years ago, you know, the small group in a spare bedroom, that's now on its way to, you know, a percentage of an entire, you know, subcontinent of protected areas, absolutely incredible.
Thank you.
So how has the organization grown over 25 years? So it started with a small group and it is flourished and grown. So how big is the staff, and you know, is there a kind of a central location of focus, or does it really span the entire country?
It spans the entire country. We have the headquarters is in Delhi, in New Delhi, mm-hmm. and that's actually the only city office we have. We have 22 field stations across India, from the high Himalayas to marine. I employ, I think, full-time something like 250 staff at the moment. So, yeah, it has grown.
Beyond the bedroom.
Yes.
I'm so happy it has grown beyond my bedroom.
Can you imagine 250 people in there? That would be quite tricky.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think we'll talk more about the, you know, about elephants specifically, but one thing that, you know, you mentioned that you started as an ornithologist. You have a pretty significant Instagram presence. You post regularly. There are some absolutely stunning images of birds in particular, but every, you know, taxa of animals in it. You know, why is that a wonderful outlet for you? You know, what is the value that you see in sharing these images and your journeys?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, there are two parts to it. I mean, one is the whole photography thing, which has been my go-to thing for peace within myself. I go and photograph animals and birds that I'm not working on. Because if you only put elephants, that's more like work.
Yeah,
that's true.
And when you look at large mammals, especially, I can see the issues. In my mind is working on what is to be done to save them, rather than enjoy the beauty of the animal. It's sad to say that, but I rarely look at an elephant now, and not see issues concerning the elephant.
Yeah,
right. I can still look at small birds, and not necessarily know what's wrong with them. I know what's wrong with the world, but not necessarily with that individual, that species, etc. Mm-hmm. So I can take my mind off that and watch the beauty of the bird. And birds are beautiful and have brilliant song, and they're found everywhere.
Yeah.
I was just taking a walk yesterday through your zoo and spent 5 minutes looking at a brown-headed cowbird. Maybe very common to all of you.
Yeah.
And I was amazed at the song. It was sitting and singing in what I would consider very frigid temperatures. I don't know why it was singing, but it was singing.
To keep itself warm.
To keep itself warm. And so I have nothing to do with brown-headed cowbirds. So I could just look at it and enjoy it and take a photograph. But in terms of social media, I'm not just on Instagram. Actually, I've got a bigger presence on Twitter, if you care to follow me.
We'll have to
and,
do that.
And LinkedIn. These three are my platforms.
Yeah.
And I've been on it only less than 15 years. So in my career, relatively recently.
Yeah.
And that happened actually because of a young girl who worked for me in the comms division of the Wildlife Trust of India, coming to me one day and saying, "Sir, I'm your comms officer, but you don't tweet." And we youngsters want to see tweets at that time. Twitter was a big thing.
Yeah.
And we want you to tweet. And I told her, I have no idea what tweets are. I mean, I thought birds tweet.
Yeah, 100%.
We were all there at some point.
She said, I'll teach you. She said, I'll teach you. And I said, that's fine. I mean, if a 22-year-old boy or girl tells you that they will teach you something, you better learn.
Yeah,
correct. So I took her at her word, and she was good to her word, came every morning to my office and helped me tweet.
That's phenomenal.
And I got hooked. And I said, okay, I can just, you know, put what I feel like in my car or traveling. And mind you, I travel a lot. I travel 20 days a month for the last 35 years. So as I move, I can string these pieces of my thoughts together, put a picture. And before I knew it, I had 25,000 followers. And I said, good God, I mean, the world wants to actually listen to what I've got to say. So it's a great means of communicating. And I think communicating for conservation is so important because we live in our little worlds where we think we are doing great stuff and saving all these animals. But what we need to do is to mainstream it. We need to get it to people who are not conservationists. The lesser conservationists there are professionally, the better world we'll have, actually, if everybody does a little bit.
Yeah. So I have a follow-up question for that. Mm-hmm. TikTok. Have they got you on TikTok yet?
You see, they tried. They can't because in India it's banned. It's a Chinese app.
Unfortunately,
my government doesn't like China.
Yeah.
So they've banned TikTok.
One platform less to engage with. I would have liked to see the lesson plan from like a 15-year-old. This is how you learn how to TikTok. Yeah. Today we do interpretive dance. I don't know. That would have been really cool.
It keeps you younger as well, eh?
Yeah.
When you learn a new thing and a new app.
Absolutely.
It's fun.
Yeah.
It's fun.
This podcast is a production of the Global Center for Species Survival at the Indianapolis Zoo. We record all the episodes in the Beetle Financial Media Studio, made possible by a generous gift from Eric and Elaine Beetle.
I think we're going to take our conversation now to what you would call work, because we're talking about elephants now. Sorry about this. So let's focus on elephants. You're the chair of the Asian Elephant Specialist Group. Now, to everybody out there listening who might not know what a specialist group is or does, can you explain a little bit of what that entails, being a chair of a specialist group?
Yeah. So the IUCN is the world's largest group of both civil society actors and governments and individual specialists who come together under various commissions of the IUCN. Mm-hmm. One of the largest commissions is the Species Survival Commission, which basically engages in species survival. And it does so through an incredible network of nearly 10,000 volunteers at varying stages, currently 8,500, but has reached 10,000 people who work on everything from ladybirds to elephants. And the idea is to get the world's expertise on that particular taxon together in a specialist group. And therefore, the Asian Elephant Specialist Group, luckily, works only on one species, the Asian elephant. There are specialist groups that work on hundreds of thousands of species, such as the fungi specialist group. The Asian Elephant Specialist Group, therefore, concentrates on the survivability of this magnificent land animal, the largest we have in Asia, uses in a voluntary sense the expertise of today 120 members, approximately, who come together both virtually and sometimes in person to try and assist in planning, assessing, and finally either directly acting or catalyzing action, which help in the survival of the Asian elephant. I've been honored to chair this group for the last 8 years, and I've got another couple of years to go, I suppose, in this term. And 10 is a nice round number for me to have assisted in strengthening this group, and it's been fun.
So what does the future look like for the Asian elephant?
I'm by nature an optimist. Yesterday when I was freezing here, I was an optimist. Today is already a better day.
Oh, yes. There you go. Excellent.
So in conservation, you have to be in it for a long run. And the Asian elephant, interestingly, from the time I started my career 35 years ago to now, does not seem to actually have gone down in numbers dramatically in most parks. And when I started my journey, the number was 21 to 25,000 in India. And that has gone from 26 to 30,000 now. So actually a minor increase,
yeah,
right? And in the world, it was 40 to 45,000. And now it's gone 45,000 to 50,000. So actually a minor increase.
Yeah.
However, that does not mean all is well. Number one, 50,000 elephants, period, in the world, in the wild, means it's still an endangered species. Given that it's long-lived, given that it has only one calf at a time, given that the social structure of the animal, the movement patterns of the animal require vast areas of land for it to survive, we'll keep it endangered for a long time to come, actually. And what's more worrying is, although the total number of animals have almost remain the same, but it's eroding from the edges. So in countries such as Vietnam, Cambodia, Indonesia, the numbers have dramatically declined over the years. And this overall population stability, so to speak, is because of hugely increasing numbers in India, Sri Lanka, and Nepal. So South Asia seems to be going up. Southeast Asia, not so good.
So the total population numbers hides some of that local drops.
That's right. And it's very important to look at local drops, because before you know it, it could hit the center, the core.
Yeah.
And remember that elephant lifetimes are much like us. 60 years longevity average can live up to 100, just like us. So if you look at a few elephant generations to see change, it may be beyond your lifetime. And you may think all's well now, and then you might see a sudden drop when a particular era for a population is over.
Yeah, the age demographic's important, because if you have extremely an animal important. That lives such a long time, but there's a lack of recruitment, so a lack of juveniles moving up into adult stages, you know, it again, it's something that overshadows, you know, the pure numbers are not just they're not the best metric, right?
That's right. And especially when, for example, poaching, targeting only males and only large males, therefore healthier males, could completely skew even male-female ratios, not just juveniles, but skew both just the number of males existing in the population, but also skew the number of healthy males who are passing on the genes that are so critical for a species to survive.
So you mentioned poaching there. What are the kind of the three biggest threats that Asian elephants are currently facing?
Yeah, that's a great question, because when I started my whole journey, I actually started in anti-poaching. I told you earlier that trading was something that that I knew, frankly, because I used to trade myself innocently as a young boy, but partook in that thing.
But, you know, no better, do better, right?
Yeah. So after I finished my post-graduation, I didn't actually take a research job or get into conservation through a normal ecological lens. I actually started with a senior colleague of mine to set up traffic in India, which was not then a thing people talked about at all, which is the illegal trade in animals. And while he focused on the tiger bone trade, I actually focused on elephant and rhino. These were my initial years of work. And those initial years of professional work meant that I did everything a scientist should not do. I went undercover. I busted criminal rings. I traded in all sorts of things in my life. I went into 13 countries. And that was good. I was young. I had a lot of adrenaline. As a result, worked with Interpol, worked with all sorts of people in busting criminal rings. Now, at that time, poaching was a huge problem for India. When I say a huge problem, the world knows of the African elephant poaching, simply because it's been better documented.
Yeah.
And also perhaps the scale, the number of elephants being poached was always higher in Africa.
Yeah.
But as I said, when we are talking about 25,000 elephants at that stage in India, and only 2,500 being males, adult males, and of them, not many tuskers left in several populations, because tuskers were being individually chosen and poached.
Yeah.
So even the males that are left were more maknas, were adult male elephants without tusks. I mean, if people don't know, I suppose it's a good time to say that in Asian elephants, only the males have tusks and only some of the males have tusks, unlike the African elephant where both the male and the female have tusks. So if you go after an Asian elephant, you're killing only males, right? If you go after them for tusks. So there was a major problem for elephants, especially in southern India, when during those periods of time. And so I worked a lot in trying to figure out where does this ivory go? And I tracked it into the Far East, Japan, China, and tried my best to stop that going out of India. And later, when I graduated from my undercover days and traffic, I spent a lot of time, which I still do, in a UN convention called CITES. I went as an NGO, and then I went as the Indian delegation for years and years. And now I go as IUCN, but whatever the hat I wear, I've been in that convention for 32 years now, trying to talk about why ivory or rhino horn should or should not be traded internationally. And my position, India's position, is that it should not be traded internationally, even if individual sovereign countries have their own rules. But putting it out in the international market severely threatens an animal that is so dependent.
And sensitive to that trade.
Very sensitive to that trade.
So... Two other, do you have?
Oh, I'm sorry. I got stuck on one.
No, and it was immensely interesting.
That period of life so overtook me that I'm sorry. Sorry about that.
But so I remember
he wanted three yes. threats. So at that time, my focus was really on poaching and trade. Mm-hmm. And over the years, it's moved. Now that poaching and trade in India seems to have been controlled pretty well, it doesn't mean it's wiped out. It doesn't mean you take your eyes off the ball. But poaching has been more or less controlled wonderfully by the Forest Guards and Forest Service of India for tigers and rhinos and elephants, so not on one species. The focus has really shifted to space. Elephant, if you have to explain an elephant in four words, and I do that to little children, I do that to heads of state, all my life I've
done this.
Four words: big, intelligent, social, nomad. If you know these four words, you know an elephant. I mean, big, any child will tell you that an elephant is big. But biologically, big has meanings. It's a mega herbivore. It's beyond a certain tonnage. It needs a certain amount of food. It needs a certain kind of food, or rather two kinds of food. Yeah. And it needs the browse and the graze, C3 and C4 carbon. So it has to move because it's big. You can't settle an elephant. You can settle some kind of people, but you can't settle a nomad. Yeah. Or it's a bad idea to settle a nomad. So similarly, which is why I called an elephant a nomad, I know it's an anthropomorphic term, not normally used for animals, but I personally like the word nomad for an elephant better than a migratory species. It's not truly migratory, although it's in the convention of migratory species. But it perambulates almost cyclically from one place to the other, and the whole biology depends on the fact that it moves and the forest or the grassland regrows behind it, and then it comes back. Now if you settle an elephant, such as in southern Africa, where you've put in fences around all the population, then it eats itself out of the habitat, and then you come to this extraordinary question as to whether there are too many elephants. So it's not a question of too many elephants, it's a question of too many elephants at that spot.
Yeah.
If you allow the elephants to go across a natural regime of movement, you would not have that problem. So in India, we have been working a lot on corridors. The whole concept of elephant corridors was enshrined in a publication that we did 15 years ago called Rite of Passage, which actually, at that time, documented the 88 corridors in India. Now there are 101. And some people applaud and say, oh, you've got more corridors, that must be good for elephants. No, it's not good. The reason you have more corridors is as less intact habitat.
Yeah.
And as habitat fragments, you have smaller and smaller passageways connecting two habitats. So that is number two, the habitat fragmentation and the inability, because of our linear infrastructure, it could be roads, it could be railways, it could be power lines, it could be canals, especially these sort of linear infrastructure that we build that stop elephant movement is the second big threat. And the third is sometimes because of this and sometimes because of the other reason that the elephants are intelligent, which I told you, we have we have got into a situation of human-elephant conflict, which has actually overshadowed any other conflict in the world. African friends of mine would be always very, it's good for them to know when they talk of conflict and their levels of tolerance that are there in many parts of their world, to know that in India, elephants kill 400 to 450 people a year.
Wow.
Yeah.
And we call it God. And we protect it. And if an Indian touches an elephant, he goes 3 years to jail. Right? So very strict laws to protect an animal that actually kills you and kills 450 of your family or friends or kin. So it's an extreme problem. And today, I think that is the big problem that's facing the elephant, not in terms of the number of elephants that are being killed in retaliation, which actually in our parts of the world is lesser than the number of people who are being killed, but because of the erosion of the love. Elephants, by nature, are creatures that evoke awe and love, at least in my part of the world. People love elephants.
They do in this part of the world as well.
But they don't love elephants when they kill you.
Yeah.
Or they kill your child, or they kill your father. Yeah. Right? So that love is being eroded, as we talk about, if we don't find more permanent solutions to human-elephant conflict. I'm afraid that that'll be our big issue.
Justin.
Or rather is our big issue.
Oh, sorry. Justin, you just recently went to India.
I did.
For a Asian elephant specialist group meeting. Still very jealous. No bitterness in my voice. Was this the kind of stuff that was discussed there, or is what happened in India stays in India? Is that the rule right now?
No, it was definitely, I mean, it was a privilege to go. It was my first IUCN SSC specialist group meeting, and I was very honored that it was with the Asian elephant specialist group that does so much wonderful work across its range. And conflict was really kind of a central core of the main conversation. And I think, you know, having that face-to-face meeting really allows people to connect in a way that, as great as Zoom has been through the, you know, through the COVID experience, like being able to sit in the same room and have discussions with people from a variety of different range countries, from different cultural, religious backgrounds, and really kind of hone in on, like, these are the issues that we share. What are the solutions that people are trying in different places? How are they working? And realizing that they're not cookie cutter, that it is going to be very much, you know, what happens in Southern India and what's happening in Central India and Northern India isn't the same. The solutions aren't the same. But, you know, that FaceTime was incredible to watch and to see how the government officials and the NGO, you know, representatives interacted and had this true love, as you know, as you put it, this absolute love for these magnificent animals, was really quite impressive.
And we had a little bit of peace and quiet here.
We did have peace and quiet here. I'm so sorry about that. But I think, you know, we spent, you know, 4 days in meetings, sharing experiences and learned lessons. And that love for elephants really culminated in the trip to Corbett National Park. And you have this wonderful group of people that have dedicated their lives to Asian elephants. And to go out and see a family group in the wild and this complete and utter joy and like unbridled like passion and love that all of these people had for this animal, you know.
Yeah, wasn't that magnificent to see?
It was incredible.
A group of experts who should have been seeing elephants all their lives and could have been bored, but no, they were standing on top of their seats
jockeying for position, elbowing for good photos, exactly, and just like these giant, like face splitting grins looking at each other. And the entire
experts are people too.
They are people too.
Exactly.
But the rest of the evening, everyone was sharing. You know, we were all at the same spot watching the same group of animals, and we all shared our photos with each other. And this is like this shared passion was really incredible to watch. And it, you know, it is, I think, the power of the SSC and the specialist group to bring this shared expertise and passion and love and joy for the animals that they're protecting was really on display when, you know, my short trip, sadly, to India.
And Justin's been on this level ever since coming back.
I haven't shared my pictures
yet. And somewhat annoying, but yeah, sure.
But it's so important that connect, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
In which all of us, it's not just you, but all of us need that connect with the natural world to keep us going.
We do.
Is this the time to say I've also been to Corbett National Park? I saw a tiger, though.
Oh, rude. There was one of our trucks that saw a tiger, and they had the, I don't know, the joy of lording it over everybody else. And the worst part is the Jeep that I had been in, we had stopped at the same watering hole and there was a group of deer, and apologies, I don't remember which kind of deer.
Tiger food.
Spotted deer.
I think, yeah, spotted deer. And they had startled, and we all gave Kira a hard time because she had just stood up to take a picture. We're like, oh, you scared all the deer. And then we moved on, and it turns out that Kira hadn't startled all the deer. There was a tiger that had approached that we hadn't seen, and we missed viewing it at the waterhole by 3 minutes, but the Jeep behind us had the pleasure of being able to watch this magnificent creature.
You see, we have a saying in India which says a tiger sees you 1,000 times for each time you see the tiger. So the tiger was watching you and Kira 100%. And the deer.
So Kira is one of our colleagues from the SSC Chair's office that we work with a lot for our listeners. Mm-hmm. And I just love the fact that you just immediately were like, oh no, it must have been Kira startling mm-hmm. them rather than thinking maybe it's something else. We should get her on the podcast one day so she can explain herself.
Yeah. So I think, you know, it was an amazing experience. It was my first time to India, but mm-hmm. really going out into Corbett National Park was truly wonderful. But the reason I was there was for this meeting, and to be able to experience and participate in it was a wonderful experience. And it really does speak to the power of what the specialist groups are doing. You know, is there, you know, talking about what the state of the elephants are in each of their countries, what the current plans are, if anyone has any ideas or input on how those plans could be improved. And then, you know, these national action plans that are being, you know, being put out, and then putting those plans into action, putting that all this conversation to work was really quite incredible.
So Vivek, we've obviously talked quite a bit about the IUCN and the kind of work that it does, but yeah. You've been working with it for a pretty long time now. What mm-hmm. do you see it's, if you had to sum it up in, like, I don't know, one sentence take home message of what the value is of this enormous network of people, what would you say to, I don't know, passerby in the street who's like, IUCN what? How would you explain it, or why is it needed?
Yeah, I mean, you can't explain a thing of the complexity that IUCN is in one sentence.
Yeah.
The passerby on the street or the person
I'm sorry
who does
that.
Not know conservation would know of the IUCN, I suppose, largely through the Red List, which is, words like endangered or critically endangered or threatened are English words, but to the common person is used to describe the status of an animal. And that's one of the things that IUCN does, which people now take it for granted that they know that an elephant is endangered.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the day all of us finish our jobs, by the way, the elephant won't be endangered. And we could move it down to a lesser threatened category. But I think the magnificence of IUCN, and by the way, I'm on the Global Council now as well, not mm-hmm. just on the specialist group, but also on the global board, so to speak, of IUCN. The wonderful thing about IUCN is the way it combines all these constituents of individual experts, of nation states, and of organizations that are committing millions of dollars between them to save species, brings them together and offers them these spaces, these intellectual areas where they can come together under various task forces, under various specialist groups, and discuss their ideas and hopefully come to a common goal. Because in this world, I think one of the reasons we don't achieve conservation goals as quickly as we would like them to be achieved is because we all do our thing. And there's very little interplay of our ideas and our programs in such a manner that we achieve common goals. So IUCN allows that. You have a cat specialist group where a German cat specialist, who's chairing it, by the way, German-Swiss, mm-hmm. Can sit with a government which has that cat across the world. It could be from any nation. And with an organization sitting in the U.S. who's pouring millions of dollars into that cat conservation and plan as to what we can do to save that particular species. So IUCN has that convening power and that technical brilliance of the shared tens of thousands of volunteer brains that have been lent to this organization to achieve that goal. That's the brilliance of it.
That's a wonderful point to wrap it up, I suppose. Thank you again, Vivek, for chatting to us. And thank you for everything that you do for the IUCN, for the Asian Elephant, and for the Wildlife Trust of India. All of that started from a bedroom. You at home can start it too if you really want to. So let that be everybody's inspiration.
Yes. It's wonderful to come from India to Indiana.
Yes, we're so glad you're here. And to echo Monty, we appreciate you taking the time this morning, and we appreciate the work that you do and the assistance that you've given this office as we've come on board and try to help the specialist groups do what they're doing a bit more effectively. And it's been a pleasure.
Justin wants clearly another invite to India.
I wouldn't turn that down.
Which is there for everybody at the Global Center.
Excellent. Then you won't be jealous next time.
I know. I'm off now to pack my bag. Okay, bye.